Hello everyone,
we're back.
Hello.
So this is part two of our first episode of season two. Still on Bosnia, we had so much to discuss that we just felt like we needed to stretch over two episodes.
Here we're going to kind of dive into the sticky icky breakup of Yugoslavia and the consequences that had for most of the former Yugoslavian states, but mainly Bosnia, whilst also dabbling into the museums Izan and I visited while we were there this year.
Yes, I'm very curious to hear your professional opinion.
but trigger warning, guys, because there is going to be more discussion of murder, genocide, death, and some other unpleasant topics. So if you want to bow out of these episodes, completely understandable, but we hope you stick with it because we have some really interesting stuff to discuss.
We do. And remember that you can find some videos of our visitor experiences at the museum on our TikTok page at Museums Mojitos on TikTok. And then we get to Bosnia. This is probably where our trigger warning comes into effect. So if you do want to tune out now, please feel free to do so. So Bosnia was the next to try for independence, but Bosnian Serbs, backed by Serbs elsewhere in Yugoslavia, resisted. And under the leadership of Radovan Karadzic, they threatened bloodshed if Bosnia's Muslims and Croats, who outnumbered them, broke away. The Republic had a shared government reflecting the mixed ethnic composition within the population. There was about 43% of Bosnian Muslims, 33% of Bosnian Serbs, 17% of Bosnian Croats, and some 7% of other nationalities. Bosnia's strategic position made it subject to both Serbian and Croat attempts to assert domination over large chunks of its territory. And in 1991, actually, the leaders of both Serbia and Croatia had secretly met and agreed to divide Bosnia, which basically left only a small enclave for the actual Bosnian Muslim. In Bosnia, 1992, in a referendum boycotted by Bosnian Serbs, voting for an independence, and then almost immediately after, in April 1992, Bosnian Serbs rebelled with the support of the Yugoslav People's Army and Serbia, declaring the territories under their control to be a Serb republic in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And then obviously with an overwhelming military advantage and systematic campaign of persecution of non-Serbs, the Bosnian Serbs quickly asserted control on over 60% of the country. Bosnian Croats soon followed, rejecting the authority of the Bosnian government and declaring their own republic with the backing of Croatia. And yeah, this essentially is what leads to the conflict turning into the one of the most horrific modern time bloody fights for territories, with civilians becoming the victims of the most heinous crimes. Basically, between 1992 and 1995, an inhumane plan was executed to ethnically cleanse, with the planned systematic and industrial killings of non-Serbs, the majority being Bosniak Muslims. One of the most well-known periods of the war was the Siege of Sarajevo, which resulted in over 11,000 deaths, of which 1,600 were just children. There were daily shellings and sniper attacks on civilians, and overall the Bosnian War and genocide resulted in an approximation of 90,000 to between 300,000 fatalities, over 200 million people being forcibly displaced, and between 20,000 and 50,000 women systematically raped. The war finally ended in 1995 after the representatives of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia and Yugoslavia, comprising of Serbia and Montenegro, signed the General Framework Agreement for Peace in Bosnia and Herzegovina in the US city of Dayton, Ohio. And then we have Montenegro in 2006, who declared its independence from Serbia when Montenegrin voters basically just said yes, they want out. But yeah, basically the extent of crimes in this war, I literally classified as crimes against humanity. And I think most of the museums Izan and I went to focus largely on this. One of which, like, which kind of goes alongside the siege as being one of the most horrific things to happen, is the Srebrenica massacre.
Yeah.
To a gallery we went to, actually, that showed that.
Yeah. That was probably the most impactful one. Well, they were all impactful in different ways, but I think both of us were just blown away by what we kind of learned there, because it was a really informative display of like photographs, films. Some of it was documentary and some of it was like films that have made recreating events and that kind of thing. But yeah, it was just really powerful. So just for a bit of context about Srebrenica, in 1992, a few towns along the eastern border of Bosnia, which is the border with Serbia, they'd managed to mount a little bit of military defense against the Bosnian Serbian paramilitary, who wanted to declare that whole area Serbian, like part of the kind of Serbian Republic, the Republic Srpska, which is the VRS, otherwise known as, which I'll refer to it as further on. And yeah, basically there are a couple of towns in that that were Muslim towns, and they wanted to, you know, defend themselves because they saw the ethnic cleansing taking place. People were being forcibly taken from their homes and either murdered or their homes were set on fire and they had to leave. So a couple of towns managed to put up some kind of defense, but not many. So local Bosniaks would be killed or sent to concentration camps where they could be tortured or mutilated and raped, and all of the mosques were just destroyed by the Bosnian Serbs, or the VRS, as they kind of took over the territory. The Srebrenica population held out and were flooded with refugees who were coming from, you know, all these places that had been completely decimated. They, you know, put up a defense there, but they were isolated with limited water, food. Like, they didn't have running water. They had limited food. They didn't have medical supplies coming in. They were really, you know, in desperate measures. They only had a few weapons of what they could put together. They weren't armed like the military that were coming after them. They were just normal people putting up a fight. And so they formed a small military force with what they could, and mostly kind of guerrilla fighting with the limited weapons that they could find, but most of them didn't have uniforms. Some of them just threw stones if they didn't have weapons to use. And they were kind of stuck this way for months of just being kind of starved out and shelled. So the UN visited at one point in, I think it was 93, and they just, you know, the people of the town just implored them to help. And because, you know, they just weren't getting anything, even humanitarian aid coming through was just because they were surrounded on every side, it wasn't getting to them. So the UN did step in and grant it safe zone status. However, this wasn't really enforced. And I think it's difficult to see kind of, I suppose with hindsight, you're like, oh, well, the UN could have done more. I think they definitely could have done more because it wasn't really enforced to any great measure. And there was very limited intervention of any kind. It was basically just that they allowed humanitarian aid to get through and stopped people being killed in their homes for a time. There was a Dutch troop stationed there. But by 1995, the VRS troops were stopping the aid getting through. And if troops left, like the Dutch UN troops, if they left, they weren't allowed back into the area. So the defense force, well, they weren't even defending. They were just there to keep the peace. They just kept getting smaller and smaller. And eventually, by 1995, there was the Srpska force could see that there was no defense against them and they could take over the town, and that's exactly what they did. So the people who were left, like the inhabitants of the town, they fled to the Dutch compound. Many of the men feared a massacre. They knew what was coming. So 10 to 15,000 men set off on a walk or death march of over 70 miles or 110 kilometers to try and get to the actual Bosnian held territory. So they were basically going to try and go like the back routes through the forests to try and make it to safety and hope that they weren't spotted along the way. Only half of them made it. The rest of them were all rounded up and ambushed en route. So once the people that were in the Dutch compound, they were kind of protected to an extent. The women and children, at least, were put onto buses. And the men were told that they would be put onto buses later. They were just getting the women and children out first. However, there were no buses that came back for them. So the women and children were ferried out, packed hundreds of people onto these buses, and the men, and this includes boys of like 14, 15 years old. It wasn't like grown fighting men. This was just any male inhabitant of the town who wasn't a child. They were left there, and the VRS rounded them up because they were left behind. They took them to school buildings or warehouses and kept them locked in for a couple of hours, a few days, depending. And then eventually, along with the people that they'd found on the route trying to do their walk to freedom, all of those men were all rounded up and taken to empty fields where they were lined up and shot en masse. Pretty dark stuff. There were mass graves dug for them, and 8,372 men and boys were killed this way. They were in those empty fields, they were just shot where they stood, flung into the mass graves, and then the VRS, a few days or weeks later, tried to cover their tracks a little bit because they knew that people would find these mass graves and, you know, figure out what happened. So to put the UN and, you know, the survivors off the scent, they made new mass graves. They went there with diggers, they digged up bodies, they moved them to a new location and then a new location. And so a lot of the bodies were found in 2, 3, up to 5 different locations, just scattered. So over the years after the conflict ended, people have gone back to, you know, try and find their family members. And they've actually used some of the most advanced DNA tracking software and technology available to be able to identify who, like, what remains belong to what person. Sometimes they, you know, had identifying pieces of clothing or shoes or whatever that their family members could tell who they were. But most of the time, because it's just body parts in different places, they've had to use this DNA evidence to put the bodies back together. And so now there are 6,500 of them that are identified and buried. They have kind of an official memorial site at the site where the Dutch troops have been stationed, but over 1,000 are either still unidentified or they've just not been discovered yet. Some of the families have wanted to bury their family members privately, so they haven't been buried on the same plot, but there are still lots of unidentified bodies. So the gallery itself shows photos of pretty much all of this. Like, it's quite intense. It shows photos of the families left behind. It shows photos of the victims, what human remains belong to which person. This photographer is called Tarek Samara. It's his permanent collection of photographs. And yeah, it's really powerful stuff.
Yep.
You went to the museum, right? In Sarajevo.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How was your experience?
I think by that stage we'd become a bit used to what we were seeing.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Because that was one of the last ones we went to, yeah, wasn't it? But it was still very powerful.
Definitely. I think the way it was curated was great as well. We had an audio guide, which explained things to us, because a lot of museums and museums in general don't really explain the context that well sometimes.
Or there's tons of writing. Like, the Museum of Crimes Against Humanity is really informative, but it's kind of all written down. And so you get a little bit overwhelmed by the text,
yeah,
I think.
It's a lot of words.
Whereas it was good to have an audio guide. Yeah. So you have like the visual of looking at the photos, and then you have an audio guide explaining what you're seeing.
Yeah.
I think that was a really good, really well curated.
And the photographs themselves that are there are actually beautiful in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, they're obviously of gruesome things. They're not always of gruesome things. There are photographs of, for example, a mother waiting to hear of what happened to her children in her home. So it's actually got photos of people in their homes, how their homes were, how they were set up, and really conveys visually the feeling of the aftermath of the massacre. Yeah, I don't know. Highly recommend.
Yeah.
If you're there.
Yeah. Also, sadly, it shows photos from like the Dutch compound and like the graffiti of the Dutch UN soldiers.
Yeah.
Who like just wrote these kind of racist slogans against the people that they were meant to be protecting. So,
do you have examples? Or?
Yeah, I think we took some photos, but there was one that was like, "What's got no teeth and smells like shit?" a Bosnian girl.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's really awful stuff.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah, there were just some really kind of...
Yeah.
Distasteful, racist kind of... And a lot of warmongering slogans as well, like, we war for breakfast, that kind of thing. I don't think that's a direct quote, but it was something like that.
It honestly felt like you'd put a bunch of school children, high school children, to be UN guards, and they have the immature graffiti of, you know, hatred and pettiness on public objects, and then you actually zoom out and you're like, no, this is actually UN peacekeeping professionals who are actually playing a really instrumental
role. So this is not from the Bosnian Serbs, it's from the UN.
It's the UN.
This is from the UN. This the Dutch
force. I didn't imagine that.
And I think when you also think about that in the context of this little impact that the UN had in protecting these people, like, they just basically, okay, yes, they got the women and children out, but all those men, those 8,000, over 8,000 men, they just left them to be massacred.
Who, not all of their photos, but a big chunk of these men take up the first exhibition room, their photos.
It's over 500, isn't it? Over 500 of their faces you see.
You see these people, and yeah, it's confronting, to say the least.
Yeah, and it's tragic that this is so recent, you know? And it's in the middle of Europe.
I remember the conflict. Like, it's first kind of big conflict other than the Northern Irish one that I remember growing up. Then it just seemed so other. Like, it seemed like... I don't think I'd even... Because I was so young, I don't think I'd even necessarily made the association that it was within Europe. But now, you know, especially living in Greece, I'm like, it's like three countries away, you know? It's so close.
You said it well. Like, people sometimes, they feel that what has happened there, it's not Europe, like, it's something else. And it doesn't get, obviously, we cannot compare wars and atrocities, you know, it's not fair, but, I mean, it's a fucking genocide that happened less than 30 years ago, you know?
Literally in most of our lifetimes.
And because it's not Germany, it's not in Western Europe, it's like from these lost Balkan countries, it happened there. It kind of gets ignored, you know?
Like that saying, I think it was Edmund Burke who said it, about the Nazis, all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Well, good men did do nothing. Like, the West saw that happening and they didn't intervene. And that's not to say that they should. I know there's obviously a big debate in politics about whether America and Europe should get involved in these kinds of, you know.
But they do play with lives at this point.
Especially when it was within Europe. Like, there's not many things that I agree with Margaret Thatcher on, but I was watching a documentary on her, as I do. And yeah, she was very kind of pro-intervention in Bosnia.
Wow,
and, you know, I just feel like...
But someone... she was not a prime minister back then, right?
No, it was after she'd been deposed for John Major. But yeah, she kept telling them that they had to do something.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
Did you go to any other museums related to the war?
Yeah, I think probably the museum that puts this the most on display, the horrificness of this all, is, as we mentioned, the Museum of Crimes Against Humanity and Genocide. There you see things up and personal, raw, tragic, horrific, confronting, disturbing images, artifacts, videos, reading, like everything you can imagine is on display.
Every room is like packed with
packed
stuff. Like either videos or artifacts and objects.
Yeah.
Belongings of people.
I honestly didn't expect it to be the way it was because I've just never seen something like this before. And before you walk in, it already sets you up for what you're about to see. And one of the things that I particularly appreciated was the emphasis on the fact that these things are on display to keep a memory alive that therefore is integral in avoiding the same type of shit happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it plays on that dark heritage impact where we need to know about these things so we do not do them again.
Yeah.
And yeah, before you walk in, it's like, dear visitor, you are now entering the Museum of Crimes Against Humanity. You will enter inside the human hearts that no longer beat and the core of human pain and suffering. Nevertheless, it's important. It's a great way to learn about what happened. And yeah, it's actually relatively newish. It opened in 2016. And one thing that I didn't know, but which I really appreciate, it's actually run and made by a group of survivors. Oh, really? And victims, yeah, with the help of researchers as well.
Because a lot of the contents, like the objects of the museum, a lot of those are either belongings of survivors, of dead victims, or objects from, say, the concentration camps. That was one that I think hit for me quite hard, was like seeing the torture chair that people were strapped to. Seeing like this woman who'd had a restaurant, and her, because she was Muslim, you know, she was thrown out of her home, her restaurant was raided, and when she was in the concentration camp, the plates that they used, she recognized them as the ones from her restaurant, and they were being used in the concentration camp. So she, like, when she, you know, the concentration camp was shut down and she finally got to leave, she took one with her as like a memento of like, this was my life, and then this was my life again.
Yeah,
I think what got me the most was seeing actual photographs of dead bodies, wounded bodies, blood blown up, bodies laying on the ground, just very confronting things. And it's like, that's not new to me as a person who is interested in history. You know, crimes have been committed throughout time, but the thing is, these photographs are in color. They're in clothes that my parents or my cousins wore in the 90s. These people look like me. They look like people I know, because they are not that far away in time. And that is just something I've never seen before.
Yeah.
And it is a very chilling part of the museum and reality of the situation.
And I think when you see like wars on the news, obviously they're very sanitized versions. So yes, you see the buildings explode, you see the bombs going off, but you don't really see that much the people lying dead in the street, bleeding out. You don't see that side of it so much. And so, like, yeah, just seeing so much of that.
I think from what you're telling me, it's very nice how they have curated the museums with these personal stories.
Yeah.
In his personal touch, because you as a visitor can associate yourself better with the narrative, right?
Yeah,
definitely. And that's what should be done, in my opinion. You should seek out the voices of victims, of survivors, of people who were involved to tell their own story.
Yeah.
Because that's another absurd thing if you think about it. Like, most of the people who were killing each other during that war just 5 years ago were friends.
Yeah.
And we're living together, and...
Yeah, that was another thing that some of the testimony said, actually. Like, you know, the people who were guards of my concentration camp, you know, people who raped me, they had been my neighbors. Yeah, I recognized them. Literally. They were people I knew.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you just think, like, God, can you... Like, just putting yourself in that position of the people that you'd grown up side by side with, you know, who you went into their bakery or whatever, and then suddenly they turn against you.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That had the biggest impact for me, I think, was the personal stories.
Yeah. I actually felt really uncomfortable in that museum. I wanted to leave.
Mm.
But I think that's what it's probably meant to do.
Mm.
Like, it's very confronting. I literally wanted to cry.
Yeah.
And the War Childhood Museum?
Yes. So that's another one that is very kind of closely related to individual people's stories. It started as an online project to gain basically people's interpretations of the question, what was the war childhood to you, by Jasminka Halilovic in 2010. It started this crowdfunded book, and it was, I think it was Twitter, was it, that she told us that it started on?
Like, I think it's like a replies to a Twitter post or something. Yeah.
And so they got these responses to what the war kind of childhood meant to them, like growing up in war, how did that impact you, what response do you have to that? And so the book was published in 2013 with more than 1,000 contributions, and then in May 2015 the museum creation process started, and so they gathered not only the stories from people but also objects that people would like to kind of donate that represent their childhood in war. And so there was kind of a real combination of, some of them were objects that were, say, given to them by someone who died in the war, and maybe a toy or something that they received. Some of them were related to their school or their ambitions as a child and how that was affected by the war. Some of them were belongings of family members who died. There was the jungle gym, which I thought was a particularly intense one, where I think it was 5 children were killed when a shell fell on this like climbing frame jungle gym in the children's play area, and the surviving children, their families kept it and donated it to the museum.
Yeah.
There were also messages of hope, like there was humanitarian aid in there. I don't know how common this is, but in the UK, it's quite a common thing, especially at Christmas, to do the shoebox appeal, where less fortunate families or children in countries going through war or something, you put together a shoebox of items that they might need, maybe some sweets or things that won't go off, you know, like packaged sweeties, and maybe some colouring books or toys or just something, so that they'll have things to open on Christmas. And basically every school child does this, like it's just a thing that we do. And then to see the impact of that from the other side, like to see the real children that received those, I found that really powerful. Like I actually started crying. Like Nikki was like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. But yeah, like my mum still does that every year. Like she was telling me when I told her about it, she was like, yeah, I'm doing one at the moment. Aww. It's like, well, yeah, like
That's so sweet.
Yeah, like because she does scouts and things. She's very involved in the community. But yeah, so, you know, that's still something that children do now.
Yeah.
And to see that that actually does have an impact on people. They're not just kind of
totally
faceless, nameless.
Just what this particular example, the Bosnian little girl had been trying to find her sender for years.
Yeah.
Decades.
And actually she turned up in Australia.
So sweet.
I reached out to the museum because it didn't say like whether she ever found her, so I messaged the museum like, can we try to find her? Like, should we put together a campaign to find this girl? And they were like, we actually found her, she's in Australia.
That was a very unique museum.
Yeah,
it really was. From the perspective of children.
Yeah, it's the only one like it in the world as well, or the first one like it in the world. And in 2018, it won the Council of Europe Prize for Museum of the Year. It's been recognised, which is good because it was really different.
It deserves to be,
And the staff there were really knowledgeable as well.
They sat us down in the beginning, gave us a rundown. It was amazing, actually.
Yeah, they kind of told us the whole intro of how it started and where it's going and how now they accept entries from not just like Bosnian, you know, victims, but also from current wars as well. So Syrian children, Afghanistan.
Had their stories as well.
Yeah, had a few entries of those.
Yeah, and actually, literally, we squeezed every free second we had into going to museums. And it was literally like the morning of our flight, we got up super early, got a cab to the suburb of Butmo and saw the Sarajevo Tunnels of Hope.
Yeah.
Which I actually didn't know about prior to researching about Sarajevo. But basically during the siege of Sarajevo, the entire city was cut off from any sort of supplies. So people actually dug a tunnel that was done by the citizens themselves. And it basically linked the city, which was entirely cut off by Serb forces, with the Bosnian held territory on the other end of the supposedly neutral area of the Sarajevo airport controlled by UN forces. And yeah, basically through this tunnel, food and humanitarian aid got in and out. There was no other way for that stuff in a freeway to be transported in and out of the city. Yeah, it was impressive, don't you think? Mm-hmm. Like, it had a mine shaft. It was like a railway. It eventually had drainage pipes put into it. And it had, at one point, they implemented like crossing points where if you were coming from two different sides, carts could pass each other and not interrupt the, like, you basically wouldn't get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this was a pretty interesting museum because it's one of those, unique places where the museum is actually the site itself.
Yeah.
And you got to go into the tunnel, you got to walk in it, you saw like a small section of it, and it had examples of what type of things were going on, like patients were transported in these tunnels, like lives were saved in these tunnels, people escaped in these tunnels. Actually, the Bosnian leader, Aliha Izetbegović, also used it when he was leaving the city to join international peace talks. So it's crazy that you could go visit it and see it. And it was, pretty cool.
Because it went directly under the airport, didn't it? Which was like basically cordoned off by the UN. Like no one could cross there. Like the Serbs couldn't cross, but they bombed it quite often. And the Bosnians couldn't cross. And if Bosnian people were trying to cross, often the UN troops would stop them and turn them back again.
Yeah.
So yeah, this kind of became people's only alternative was to use these tunnels.
Yeah. And speaking of the airport, actually, this reminds me of episode number 3 of Monuments, Museums and Mojitos, where we speak about Eurovision and the example of how Bosnia in 1993 got to Eurovision, which was... Yes, refer to this episode for more info. But basically, yeah, it was not a smooth transition out of the country.
But I felt that impact when I was stood like on the tarmac, didn't you?
You're like at an airport, around. Probably the most boring place in the entire world. And you're like, oh my God, what was his name? Mohammed Fazla and his band like literally dodged rifles to get on a plane.
Yeah.
And they
were
Ireland.
Running here where I'm standing, possibly.
Literally.
Like, we didn't know where,
literally.
Because you asked one of the locals, didn't you? Like, has it been rebuilt? Like, is it the same airport? And they were like, yeah, it's the same one.
It's the same airport. It's the same one.
We're in that famous place, that Eurovision.
Yeah, literally.
Did you have a favorite, Nikki?
Museum?
Mm-hmm.
I think the photo gallery, to be honest, that I think the combination of like the images, the video and the audio really were a nice like medium and setting to tell that story, I think.
Yeah.
What about you?
I would say the same, but that would be a bit boring. Wouldn't it? Maybe the childhood war.
Also good. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was so different.
Yeah.
And also had that personal touch. Like it was people's own. Like stories and objects that they had donated.
Yeah.
There were some like lighthearted ones in there as well. Like
they were.
The packets. Do you remember that one where it was like in the humanitarian aid? Yeah. They'd had like all these brands come in, which they'd never seen before because of communism. So it was like Western kind of brands like Pepsi. And they were like, oh, what's Pepsi?
Basically like a hoarded collection of like food packets and labels and stuff. From the aid.
Yeah, and they got in the Guinness World Book of
Records. They did. Oh, bless them. Yeah.
For like the most packets of food. Because they kept like, they didn't throw any of them out because they wanted to be like, these are all the new things that we got to try in the war.
Overall, 10 out of 10. 10 out of 10.
I really want to go back to Sarajevo and the rest of Bosnia because we only got to see the city.
Yeah.
Shout out to all the museums.
Yeah.
Yes. Guys, you do a great job. And I think a lot of them aren't actually supported by the government, which is interesting. So they're quite reliant on us as visitors supporting them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, most of them are private, I think,
aren't
they?
Yeah.
We made a few TikToks. So if you guys follow us on TikTok, then you can see some kind of behind the scenes. Or I don't know, just images of us
some
visiting.
Some insights of the content of the museums and stuff.
Maybe it's nice to give also like a small background of what is Bosnia and Herzegovina as a state following the war. It's quite complicated. So it consists of two entities, the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Republika Srpska. So within the system of the country, there is a constant backdrop of different aspirations. So Republika Srpska wants a greater autonomy. Croat parties are aiming for a third entity, and several Bosniak parties are hoping for a more centrally governed country. There is a directly elected tripartite presidency, which is in charge of foreign, diplomatic and military affairs.
So they have three presidents.
Yes, like one Bosniak, one Serb, one Croat.
Yeah, and they never agree on anything. Sometimes the presidents would just vote against each other to spite each other. Like, they never basically, if one of them came up with, you know, a new law or a new, you know, something that they wanted to propose, then the others would just vote it down out of spite. So nothing ever really gets resolved.
So it's very difficult to pass any reforms. Obviously, all the citizens in Bosnia, they want to join the EU and they aspire to be part of the European Union. But
with their current political
system, it's very difficult.
It's not going to happen. Because of how the war ended with, you know, everyone kind of being like, okay, we'll stop fighting amongst ourselves, so we'll have autonomy for each ethnic group, then it's really difficult to try and combine them all again. And because, you know, that was part of the peace treaties in a way, to say like, okay, we're gonna, this group is gonna have their own president, that group's gonna have their own president, that's what we're gonna do growing forward. So now that it doesn't work, how do you reform that? It's really difficult.
I hope that maybe with time, and I really hope there won't be any issues in that area in the following years or decades, and maybe with time they will create a common Bosnian identity with all its different ethnicities being part of it. And maybe in, I don't know, in several decades there would be a common vision in the country regarding important topics like the EU or whatever.
And Sarajevo was so beautiful. Like I've never been somewhere so diverse like that. Yeah. And that was what kind of made it special, you know, like you have the mosques calling people to prayer in the middle of the day, and then you walk down the road and you come across a Catholic cathedral, and then round the corner there's, you know, a big Orthodox church, and the people, it just mingled, you know, you don't kind of look at the people on the street and go, oh, you're one ethnic group, you're another, like everyone just goes about their day.
It might be more nuanced than that behind the scenes, but I think from our perspective of being tourists for a week, it was quite pleasant what we saw.
And I don't know, as a conclusion, should we say that don't vote for nationalistic parties? I'm just seeing that the Nazis in Bulgaria are probably, they're almost entering the parliament, so I'm thinking that I have 1 hour to go to vote.
We're not going to tell you who to vote for, but...
Don't vote for Nazis, nationalistic parties, extreme right wing.
Pretty much,
yeah.
Those would be our recommendations.
Please. Yeah.
We recommend museums and potential people not to vote for. Well, this was like a bit of a mammoth introduction. Very meaty, but we hope you enjoyed it.
And thanks for listening.
We'll be back with something a little bit more lighthearted next time, I think.
Yeah.
And if you do have any questions or want to get in touch, please do. We're at Museums Mojitos on Twitter and Instagram, and with the podcast's full name on Facebook. And in particular, if you're from Bosnia or any of the regions affected by this crisis and want to reach out to us and give us your perspective, please do. We really welcome that and would love to hear from you.
Thank you guys.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Ciao.